This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture with me, Dashran Johan. Saudi Arabia is a country that has a notoriously low human rights record, which has been characterized by its problematic treatment of women, state-sponsored discrimination against non-Muslims, and state-sanctioned racism and anti-Semitism. In September 2020, Saudi Arabia surprised many when it opened its first dog-friendly cafe. This is, of course, in addition to other extraordinary societal changes that the country is seemingly going through, such as allowing women to drive, the opening of cinemas, WWE hosting mega shows in their country. And yes, I'm talking about the pro wrestling company, as well as rap concerts. The question is, do these changes mark a sharp shift in sociopolitics in the country, or is it just a facade? Well, I certainly do not have the answer to that question, but someone who might is my guest on the show today, James Dorsey, who is a senior fellow at the S. Rajaratnam School of International Studies and the Middle East Institute. Welcome to the show, James. Let's start with a question that will hopefully give us a broad idea of what is going on. Tell us, why has Saudi Arabia been undergoing the changes I brought up in my introduction over the past couple of years?
The key to understanding what's happening is several factors. One is you've had, for all practical purposes, a generational change in leadership in Saudi Arabia. So while the king, who is an octogenarian, still is the king, a lot of power and the ability to drive things lies with the crown prince, who's a man in his early 30s. So he's a man who understands societal shifts that have taken place, including changing attitudes among youth, who constitute a majority of the population. And that includes their aspirations, need for jobs, for opportunities, for a different lifestyle with more leisure and entertainment opportunities, and also a changing attitude towards religion or towards religiosity. That's one factor. Mm-hmm. The second factor is that the crown prince needs to solidify his power base. And obviously, by catering to youth aspirations, youth desires, that's one way of doing that. The other way of doing that, which corresponds with that, is that he has shifted or is shifting what legitimizes the rule of the Al Saud family and his rule in particular from religion and a very ultra-Orthodox, ultra-conservative interpretation of the faith to a form of Saudi nationalism. Mm-hmm. And the third factor where all of this comes together, if you wish, is the fact that Saudi Arabia needs to change, particularly economically. It needs to diversify its economy. It needs to streamline its economy. That means that the constructs that existed in the past, imposed by cultural and religious norms, like the ban on women's driving, like greater restrictions on gender, the mixing of genders, like the invasive power that the religious police had, like women's right to driving. You need to change those things to enable economic reform.
So you brought up the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and the economy. And I think this ties into the Crown Prince's vision for Saudi Arabia, Vision 2030, am I right?
Well, almost all Gulf states have a vision that projects several decades into the future. And it's a vision of economic diversification primarily. Crown Prince Mohammed has his Vision 2030, which talks about all, you know, on the one hand, the social change, some of which we've seen, that is supposed to help and promote economic reform and economic diversification, talks about the development of various sectors of the economy, whether that's other resources and minerals, whether that's manufacturing, whether that's tourism, and also involves these mega high-profile projects, mega cities, $500 billion, that are supposed to be futuristic and drive development. The fact of the matter is that when you look at, you can debate various aspects of that plan. Since that plan was unveiled, the world has changed. You've had a phenomenal economic downturn. You've had an initial collapse and of the energy markets, oil and gas, with some return, but nowhere close to what Saudi Arabia minimally needs to pay its bills and fund diversification. Forget funding mega projects of the kind that he has proposed. And the prospect that energy markets, oil, gas, may not return to what they were in the past, that countries are going to increasingly move towards alternative forms of energy. Now, to be fair, the Crown Prince has made renewables and alternative forms of energy a priority. But nonetheless, this is not going to be as, it's never was going to be an easy transition, but it certainly is not going to be as easy a transition as we had prior to the pandemic.
And can you perhaps shed some light on how a more liberal Saudi Arabia can also benefit its economy?
First of all, let's define liberal. We're not talking about politically liberal. If anything, Saudi Arabia has become far more repressive.
Right.
Far more repressive domestically and more repressive regionally. What we are talking about are degrees of social liberalization, and there are a fair number of steps to go yet if you really want to talk about being socially liberal. But the economic aspect is very simple. Half your population are women. They're restricted in their ability to become productive economic players in the economy. If they are restricted in their ability to move around town and you have to impose extra costs because they need to have a trusted driver, which may also mean a separate car, then those restrictions impact your economy significantly, particularly if you're moving away from an economy that relies primarily on the rent, if you wish, of oil exports.
Now, I can't help but wonder if all of this is just surface level stuff. Because on the one end, we're talking about how an oppressive country is finally giving its people more freedom. But on the other hand, activists, particularly women activists, are still getting arrested. There are reports indicating that these activists were also tortured in captivity. So, James, can you help me make sense of this contradiction?
First of all, I think the way to look at this is economic diversification and what that entails, including a lifting of various social restrictions, is no longer a choice. Whoever rules Saudi Arabia has no choice. He has to embark on a program of economic reform and diversification. So if you want to retain power, or if you want to, for all practical purposes, institute one-man rule, then you're going to have to be successful on the economic front. So, you know, this is not a prince who's liberating. This is a prince who's doing what he needs to do to solidify his power base. Autocracy is no longer what it was in the past. Autocrats have to deliver, certainly on public services and goods. And that's what he's doing. At the same time, you know, as far as I'm concerned, his vision is one-man rule. And that means he tolerates no dissent. He tolerates no criticism. He tolerates no degree of freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, freedom of the media. And he is willing to do what it takes to concentrate power. And he's demonstrated that not only with the arrests of activists, including the women activists, who were the ones who really deserve the credit for the lifting of the ban on women's driving, and who went to great risk to push for the lifting of that ban. But he's arrested scores of other activists, if not hundreds of other activists, human rights activists, lawyers, academics. He's arrested scores of his family members. He's grabbed power, grabbed money in these power grabs under the mum of an anti-corruption campaign. So, you know, that's the logic. This is about his power and the things he needs to do, which include, first and foremost, maybe even economic diversification and degrees of social liberalization that are prerequisites for that. But it's about cementing his power and in the process projecting himself as the agent of change in a kingdom that was viewed as austere, backward-looking, inward-looking. He needs to project an image of a forward-looking, cutting-edge, technological kingdom if it wants to, for example, attract foreign investment. Now, the problem is that his repressive behavior, if you wish, whether that's the arrests of the businessmen and family members, whether that's the arrests of the activists, including the women activists, whether that's the killing of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018 in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, whether that's putting spies in Twitter that disclose all kind of information of accounts that are critical of Saudi Arabia and the Crown Prince, that hasn't done his image very well. Not to forget the war in Yemen.
I'm glad you brought up Yemen because that's something we definitely need to talk about. But for now, we do need to take a quick break. After the break, James and I will continue our conversation on if Saudi Arabia is really becoming a more progressive country or if it's all just a facade. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Darshan Johan and zooming in is James Dorsey, a senior fellow at the S. Rajaratnam School of International Studies and the Middle East Institute. And we are having a conversation on the changing Saudi Arabia. And if the country is becoming more progressive, perhaps, or if it's all just a veneer. So, James, let's talk about the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. There seems to be conflicting reports and speculation on who he is as a person. Is he personally someone who is forward-thinking, or is he someone who is just pretending to do so? What is your take on this?
Look, I think the picture is more nuanced. First of all, it may very well be, and that Prince Mohammed's own attitude towards religion are more liberal than those of his father's generation. So a lot of this change may very well stroke with his own social beliefs and not simply be opportunistic. And of course, look, the image of Saudi Arabia for many decades was one of backward looking. So obviously, every time something that breaks that mold happens, a dog cafe, a concert, a cinema, whatever it may be, is going to attract attention. But there has been so much or such excesses in terms of the dark side of all of this that all of those headlines about dog cafes and whatever at this, are equaled by the headlines that are not as positive. The way the war in Yemen is being conducted. The fact that Yemen is the world's worst humanitarian crisis, or one of the world's worst humanitarian crises today, in which children, women are deeply affected, in which you have cholera epidemics. People have not forgotten the killing of Jamal Khashoggi. People have not forgotten the arrests. And so, you can have all of those headlines, but they're not good enough. Now, to give you an example, had Saudi Arabia dealt transparently and openly with the aftermath of the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, the impact of that killing may have been different. So Saudi Arabia, first of all, changed its story three times over several weeks, and none of those stories were credible, and nobody bought any of those stories. There is no transparency in the judicial process. We have no idea who was charged. We have no idea why people who were identified were not charged. We have no idea what evidence was brought forward in the judicial proceedings and what that evidence would have told us with regard to what happened in Istanbul. We still don't know what happened with the body of Jamal Khashoggi. We don't have no idea where it is. Presumably, those people who were sentenced in Saudi Arabia have to have some indication of where it was. So Crown Prince Mohammed has not done himself a favor with the lack of transparency, which, you know, would have helped him sort of put this behind Saudi Arabia and behind him. And therefore, the other moves that he makes, gaining not only greater credibility, but also greater acknowledgement.
So a lot of what we've been saying, I think, highlights Saudi Arabia right now as the kingdom of contradiction. But I was speaking to an acquaintance whose family is based in Saudi, and she said, well, things aren't great, but she feels that there is more freedom now than there ever has been, particularly when she was growing up. So I'm wondering if these contradictions and inconsistencies are all part of the process of change and reform.
First of all, the fact that you have contradictions in almost anything that the Saudis are doing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, having said that, that may very well be the nature of the beast. So that may very well be the nature of a process of change. You know, change does not happen overnight. And it's not by the stroke of a pen simply. Therefore, it need not necessarily be linear. And these contradictions may just simply be the nature of the beast that over time get ironed out. Now, I think that's true for some of the contradictions. I think on other issues, it has to do with the specific nature of who Crown Prince Mohammed is and how he wants to rule. Point number two is, the fact of the matter is, a lot has changed in Saudi Arabia. If you are a woman who wants to drive, can afford driving lessons, and can afford buying a car, or if you are a youth, male or female, who can afford to buy the tickets to a concert or a WWE event or whatever it may be, then something fundamentally has changed in your life. You couldn't do this 2 years ago.
Right.
I mean, that's, like it or not, real change. Now, I think there's a much more fundamental issue, and it also goes to a much more larger, in my mind, global struggle going on. You know, we've implicitly been talking about reputation, about image, both of the Crown Prince as well as of the country. And part of being able to drive that economic diversification process forward, of attracting foreign investment, attracting domestic investment for that matter, and regional investment, is being able to project a forward-looking image, being able to garner soft power. One of the elements of what Saudi Arabia is trying to do in competition with others like the UAE, like Turkey, like Iran, like Indonesia, and to a lesser degree, Malaysia, for example, is to project the image of a religiously pluralistic, tolerant society that engages, for example, in interfaith dialogue.
And just a quick follow-up to that, is there a chance that the Crown Prince might be personally more liberal and is really trying to make Saudi Arabia a more progressive country, but he himself is facing resistance within the country from other members of the authorities or royalty who perhaps prefer if things remain exactly as it was?
I think that would be an oversimplification.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, what I mentioned at the beginning, these changes were inevitable. There was no way around them. These changes were no longer a choice. So whoever would have been in office would have had to make these changes. It so happens that it's Crown Prince Mohammed, and indeed he has the advantage. He has the generational advantage. But first of all, ultimate authority in Saudi Arabia today lies with his father.
Mm.
His father has allowed this to happen and encouraged this from day one. So, with other words, that would deny the generational aspect. Second of all, some of this stuff started before the rise of King Salman and started already under King Abdullah. Now, King Abdullah initiated certain reforms. He wasn't pushing it a lot of things as forcefully as the Salmans have done. But, you know, some of these changes started under Abdullah and have been pushed much more forcefully by the Salmans. Second of all, there is no question that there are parts of Saudi Arabia that are struggling with this change for a variety of reasons. But virtually all power centers in Saudi Arabia have been emasculated by the crown prince. The religious establishment are his parents.
Hmm.
And those that are not are in jail or simply keep quiet. So it's not a question of resistance. I think you're dealing with a man who understands the need for change, but the change is also a tool to solidify power and maintain power.
Okay, now let's talk about Yemen, which you touched on earlier. The crisis in Yemen is a complex one. It involves multiple countries and religious factions and has caused Yemen to suffer the largest humanitarian crisis in the world. We can do an entire episode on it, but for the purpose of this discussion we're having today, James, in brief, what is Saudi Arabia's role in the war that's going on in Yemen and how does it tie to what we've discussed so far?
Look, I think you need to look at Yemen in a broader context. So you have Saudi Arabia, but also other Middle Eastern states, who for the past decade have been increasingly uncertain about the reliability of their protector. Ultimately, you're talking about states that cannot defend themselves.
Right.
And keep in mind that 5 years into the war in Yemen, and this is a war that Saudi Arabia is conducting, this is not a great track record for the Saudi military. On the contrary, despite the fact that Saudi Arabia is one of the largest buyers of weaponry in the world and some of the most sophisticated weaponry that's available on the market. And yet this war has turned out to be a disaster. Now, the importance of this atmosphere of unreliability has been that various leaders, including Mohammed bin Salman, but not only Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince of the United Arab Emirates, Mohammed bin Zayed equally, have come to the conclusion that they need to hedge their bets. They have no alternative to the United States. China, Russia, whoever, are not alternatives, neither willing or capable of taking over the defense umbrella as such. The U.S. is going to retain some degree of commitment in the Middle East, but we don't know what kind of commitment and to what degree. And so you've seen regional leaders try to hedge their bets by basically reshaping the region, whether that's the confrontation with Iran, part of it being a corollary in the war in Yemen, the failed attempt to change the prime minister in Lebanon, Syria, Libya, where the Saudis are less involved or secondary to the Emiratis, but nonetheless. And so, and a lot of these efforts have turned out to be fiascos. They've backfired not only in their failure to achieve Saudi Arabia or Saudi Arabia and the UAE wanted to achieve, but they've also backfired in terms of the image of the country. And so I think that the UAE is to a large degree withdrawn from Yemen because it basically realized that it was only going to lose and the sooner it gets out, the better. I think that the Saudis and Prince Mohammed desperately would want a face-saving solution. And so they're stuck.
All right, James, I've just got one more question for you before I let you go. And I think this goes back to what might end up being the title of the episode. And that is, Final thoughts, James. What do we make of the changing Saudi Arabia? And is it just a facade?
First of all, I think it depends on who you ask in Saudi Arabia. But for some people, there's been big change. Whether that's women driving, whether that's artists. For some people, there's been real change. And that's important to them. The thing to watch is whether or not Mohammed can deliver. And that means delivering on jobs, delivering on opportunity. Right now, there's a lot of uncertainty in Saudi Arabia. This has not been a good year. Saudi revenues have taken a nosedive. You've got oil prices at around $40 a barrel, $45 a barrel, whatever it may be. Saudi Arabia needs $80 to break even. And the chances of it coming back to that anytime soon are relatively low. You have a globally depressed economy, which means that you have globally depressed demand. And you've had the introduction of a value-added tax. You've had cutbacks on bonuses. Economic diversification, if it's done correctly, means moving away from secure government jobs. 70% of Saudis are employed by the state today. And moving that towards the private sector, towards an empowered private sector. So a lot of Saudis feel at the moment very uncertain about where. And to be fair, that's true for people across the globe today. It's true for people in Western countries, the United States. People feel very uncertain about their futures. Or Malaysia.
Yeah.
You know, across the globe. Doesn't matter where you look. So being able to deliver on those fundamentals, jobs and opportunities at all kinds of levels, is going to be key to whether or not Prince Mohammed succeeds. And again, to be fair, it's going to be key to whether or not a lot of leaders succeed. In Saudi Arabia, it's, of course, particularly stark because it all turns around one man today. And, of course, because this is a process of change from what Saudi Arabia was to what Prince Mohammed would like it to be, that is far more invasive and fundamental than it is, for example, in Malaysia or the United States or wherever else.
Okay, I know I said last question, but I have a very, very quick follow-up to that. If the Crown Prince, like you alluded to, fails to deliver on his promise on fixing bread and butter issues, is there a chance that we could see the country revert back to its old ways? You know, perhaps an even more repressive and oppressive regime than it is now.
Your guess is as good as mine. Let me give you one little fact. Mm-hmm. You can draw your own conclusions from that. In a recent public opinion survey that was conducted by the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, one of the questions that was asked of Saudis was, is it a good thing that we don't have protests the way other Arab countries like Egypt, Tunisia, Yemen had, Libya, Sudan, Algeria, Iraq, Lebanon? Is it a good thing that we don't have those kind of demonstrations and protests? And the response was split down the middle. 48% said it's not a good thing that we have those. We should have those protests. And 48% said it's not a good thing. Now, what that means at the very least is that if there were expression of discontent, a significant portion of the population may not join, but they certainly would empathize.
Hmm.
Food for thought.
It certainly leaves us with a lot to ponder upon. Thank you so much for joining me today, James.
My pleasure. I enjoyed it.
I've been speaking with James Dorsey, Senior Fellow at the S. Rajaratnam School of International Studies and the Middle East Institute. And we were talking about the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and if some of the changes we've been hearing about over the past couple of years, such as allowing women to drive and the launching of the country's first dog-friendly cafe, Are these changes signs that the country is becoming more progressive, or is it all just a facade? So if you missed any part of this conversation or any previous Live and Learn episodes, you can check out our podcast on the BFM app, bfm.my, or you can subscribe to us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Just search BFM Live and Learn. Once again, I'm Darshan Johan, and this has been Live and Learn The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.